always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Connecting Faith. Phil Arnold today sitting in for Neil Stavem. Neil's actually here. He's just up against the Velcro wall. He got in that Velcro suit and jumped up against the wall. And if I've told him once, I told him 1,000 times, do not go near the Velcro wall. So I was thinking I could either snake the microphone up toward the wall and let him do the show, or I could do it myself. So he'll be back, I bet, soon. But we wish him well. We'll try to bring you lunch up there, Neil. But what did I tell you? Do not go near the Velcro wall. Today, we've got a really exciting episode of Connecting Faith, because we have on the studio line Ken Mansfield, who wrote a book called Rock and a Heart Place, H-E-A-R-T. It's the rock and roll story of several who have gone from rebellion to sweet salvation. And including on that list are stories from the members of Buffalo Springfield, The Byrds, England Dan and John Ford Coley, Grand Funk Railroad, Korn, Pointer Sisters, and Prince, just to name a few. Not Prince himself, but someone from Prince's band. And it's interesting because I find that legendary people like the Beatles, of which Ken was the manager at one point for Apple Records, working for the Beatles, that he came alongside and worked with these, what I think are just the musical living legends. Wouldn't you say that, Ted?
Most definitely.
I mean, come on.
It's rock history, the Beatles.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And how cool that is. And I remember when I went and saw Frank Sinatra when he was at the Met. Hmm. And then I remember my sister, years before that, invited me to go see Elvis. And that was back, I think, in 75. And it's like, I don't think I want to go see that.
You didn't go.
No, I didn't go.
Oh.
And now I wished I had.
Yeah.
And now the thought of the Beatles and the chance to not only see them in person, but actually work alongside them. This is kind of a thrill for me just to be talking to Ken today. So mm-hmm. We're going to bring him on in just a minute after I say a few more interesting things, time permitting. I've got a few things
all
to right. say.
Good. We're riveted. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he wrote this book with a gentleman. And where's his name? Marshall Terrell. An award-winning biographer, so he's in good company. Our guest today is really an award-winning music producer, and he's the former U.S. manager of the Beatles Apple Records. I'll ask him more about that, because that to me is so fascinating. And he did partner with Marshall Terrell, and they wanted to talk about the wretched excess and the self-absorption and then the miraculous redemption of many musical icons. And that's what the book Rock and a Hard Place is about, and we're going to talk about that today. And we found that the journey is highs and lows, and it's got a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. But when people finally come to the truth of Christ in their life, it's pretty sweet when they come around. So we've got Ken on the studio line. Ken, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Good to see you, Bill.
Thanks. Tell us a little bit about Rock and a Hard Place, because, you know, I think you've been writing this book forever. You know, I have had a lot of similar experiences, but I just lack ambition and any kind of proactive movement, whereas you actually took advantage of all that and actually wrote a book.
Yes, I did, and I realized once the book got going that that book had been in me for a long time. And you mentioned my co-writer on this, Marshall Terrell. Marshall had done a lot of editing and historical fact-finding on my Beatle books and other books about the business. And during this time, I was always telling these stories about some of the people, not the people we were writing about, but like the people in this book and what they'd gone through. And so he kept asking me, you know, you need to write a book about that, and I'll do all the research and the historical interviews and all that for you. And I just didn't want to do it, Bill. I thought, you know, I don't want to go relive that, because I wrote a cancer book about my cancer trials, and you have to go back and relive something. And there was a lot of dark places that I went through and all of us went through, and just having to go back, like in the Bible, the dog returning to his vomit, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I just, and then also, I'd be honest with you, and you know artists because you've been around some of the famous ones over the years, is they're a pretty unusual breed of people. And the idea of assembling 12 to 16 of those in some sensible order and dealing with all the things that they come out of after these years in the business and the success and failures and organizing, you know, there's a little bit of ego involved and all this stuff. And I thought, wow, I've done this one at a time for the most part. Do I want to do it with 12 or 16 people? And so it was rather daunting, but I'm trying to make this short. But what happened is he said, Marshall finally said after about 2 or 3 years, look, it, sit down with a couple of people you really are close to and feel comfortable with and tell them about our concept. And if they agree to do a couple of chapters, do that. And if it feels right to you, we will go ahead. If not, okay, you gave it a try. Well, I did, and I got about 2 artists in, and this thing just took off. It took, went away from me. It became something that just became a real project, a real important thing, a thing that started ministering to me, you know, and just after a while, I was totally hooked on this book. So it turned out to be very fascinating to me as a writer.
And for me as a reader, I devoured it, Ken. I thought it was just outstanding. Answer this for me. Do you think that broken people naturally gravitate towards the arts?
Yes, I do. That's a funny thing that you brought that up, because very few people think like that about it. But I've often said that these people that are really famous, really have a creative, just something special about them, would have never had it unless they had these tragedies, these broken situation in their life, has really suffered through things, really experienced deep pain and deep, you know, feelings over things. It's what molds them into be able to be creative like this. And I don't think without that, and it's not saying it doesn't happen, but I think that is a key element, especially in this book. I saw this. Nobody in here had like a really easy story. I grew up, bought a guitar and it got really good and I became famous. And then, you know, it wasn't quite that simple.
Yeah, and then when they don't act the way we want them to or they misbehave, we act surprised.
Yeah, and then it turns out that's what the fans eventually want from them. When I was Waylon Jennings, you know, we were the outlaws, and people wanted us to be bad. People wanted us to mess up. People wanted us to show up late and be stoned. They wanted us to do all these things. And as the years passed by, you know, Waylon turned to me and said, you know, this is really getting hard to live up to this, because that's what the fans want. You know,
right.
They want me to be crazy.
I think Cary Grant once said, you know, even I want to be Cary Grant. Because you have to live up to expectations that the fans have, and you just can't do it.
That's right.
All right, Ken, your resume is so impressive, I can hardly stand it. So I would like you to talk about it a little bit. I know you're probably tired of getting asked all the same questions, but right now I feel a little bit like Chris Farley interviewing Paul McCartney on Saturday Night Live. Remember when you were like with the Beatles?
Yeah. Oh, I do.
Talk about what your job was and how you were involved on a day-to-day basis when you were a manager of the Beatles at Apple Records.
Well, through a really unusual sequence of events, which as I look back, I realize God had his hand on this the whole time, and he had this long-term plan. But I ended up going to work at Capitol Records. And the fact that I got one of the cream puff jobs at the label was just amazing as a person who had never been in the record business. I'd been an entertainer and done, you know, entertainment things. But I ended up with a job as a district promotion manager for the West Coast. So my job description is spending my time on TV shows, going to radio stations, touring with the artists, you know, working with them, concerts, special parties, just this whole life of doing that. And when the Beatles came through on their 1965 tour, that was exactly what I was supposed to do, hold a press conference with them, spend time, you know, that was my job.
Are you one of those good-looking guys that wear cologne?
I'm just trying to... Well, that's funny. But we worked together, and what it turned out was they were so used, because their fame was so high at that point, to working only with the lords of EMI or the chairman of the board of Capitol Industries or all kind of, you know, 60-something suits guys with gray hair. And now they're working with a young executive in the most important market in the United States who's like getting long hair like them. I'm suntan. I'm the California guy with a Cadillac convertible and the home in the Hollywood Hills with a pool. And I was kind of like everything they had kind of dreamed about, you know, growing up. So I was fascinated with their British bit, which was just mesmerizing. And they were fascinated with my California thing. So and I'm going to be honest, this is a confession right here. I didn't really get it about the Beatles. I mean, I thought they were a great band. I knew how famous they were. But I figured they were going to be like everybody else and just eventually, you know, they would fade away and the Beatles would go, who are the Beatles? You know, what's this? But So there was something very natural in our relationship because they saw I wasn't in awe of them. They were comfortable with me. I wasn't always asking to take pictures and do things like that. And so they got to learn about California from me. And it was just a real natural relationship. So out of that, because of that footing in our relationship, we were able to have a good business and develop a personal relationship at the same time.
So, Ken, when did you start to realize, though, through all of this, that there was a purpose so much bigger than music? And when did that start? When did that seed start growing in your heart, your own heart?
When I really realized that God had a different plan than my having a good time and thinking how successful I was. I mean, a plan different than that one?
Exactly. Because, if you got long hair, a Cadillac, and you're hanging with the Beatles, okay, you win. You win. You're number one.
Right.
I don't use the word hero very often, but you just are getting hero from me.
Yeah. And I happen to be a little aware of that, too. So I'm not saying I was the most humble guy in the world then.
Okay.
Fortunately, I didn't have a Lord Father God who was talking to me and telling me I should tone it down a little bit or count my blessings or realize, what this really was. So in a worldly, evil sense, I really enjoyed it,
All right, we're talking to Ken Mansfield. He wrote a book called Rock in a Hard Place. We're going to have lots more coming up with him. We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Bill Arnold today is sitting in for Neil. To Connecting Faith. So glad you joined us today. Bill Arnold sitting in for Neil. And we're talking today to Ken Mansfield, written a book called Rock and a Heart Place. I think we got a couple copies to give away today. If you'd like to try to sign up to be one of those lucky people, you can give us a call at 1-877-933-2484. And Ken, when as I'm going through your book, you have chronicled the stories of many famous people, one of which really struck me was Ruth Poynter from the Poynter Sisters. And she was talking about growing up in a pretty fundamental family with a church environment where she said, the preacher scared me. And I never saw him smile once in all the years she went to church. She said, one of the problems of that environment was being forced to try to reach perfection through Christianity, an unattainable goal that was set by the church knowing it could never be reached. And it seems to me, those are kind of scary words to a young kid if you always think that you mess up once and then it's over.
Yeah. I found that was one of the threads that seemed to prevail throughout the book is people in the book, not everybody was a Christian who then went off in the world and fell, or not everybody was a non-Christian who went through. It was like a common thing where most of the people had this bad experience growing up in the church. Because back in those days for these people, you went to church, basically. Your family went to church, or even if your mom and dad weren't Christians, they took you to church, the kids, because that was the thing to do. And like Ruth, my pastor in the church I grew up in, I never saw him smile once either. And I knew the minute I got home, I was going to hell. Or I might even make it home, because he had me so scared as I walked out of the church. And a lot of us, the minute we left home, that's the first thing we wanted to shed was the church and all that teaching, because that stuff made us unhappy, and we really wanted to be happy. And so this is a pretty common thing, and it seemed like the rougher the upbringing was, and like Ruth's case, her father was a preacher. She grew up in a very, very, I would guess, legalistic family, and that's something that these people bolted from as they were growing up and got out in the world and had these other things offered to them. Ruth Poynter's story in particular, I mentioned earlier about writing the book and how it started touching me. I have never, as a writer, this is my fifth published book, actually been crying while I'm writing a book. Her story touched me so deeply that I was actually crying when I was writing it. That's just how powerful hers is.
Ken, I would...
Incredible lady.
Yeah, I would agree that was the story that had me too. I was just so moved. She says in the book, I love how God weaves incredible tapestries by using everything in our lives so that nothing is wasted. It is amazing how he turns coal into diamonds, grapes into fine wine, and trials into treasure.
Right. And when she tells a story, I mean, you can picture her and her sisters on the stage with all the fame and all the decadence and all the excitement of the rock and roll industry. But towards the end, her story, when her one of the sisters is dying, and her and one of the other sisters crawling in bed with her as she's dying, singing their hit songs in her ears as she passed away. Wow. You know.
All right, we need to go to break so the host can cry.
Okay. Yeah, even thinking about it.
Yeah, even thinking about
it. So beautifully, yeah.
It's tough. And just the, you know, the ups and downs and the opportunities that you think when you're presented with these, how could you ever not go through with them? I mean, they reached a point where they were invited to play Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas with Paul Anka, and one of the sisters was so intimidated, she wouldn't go on the stage.
Right. And that blew it for them.
And that completely blew it. Can you imagine? Yeah. I mean, how you would feel with just the emotion? It's like you're at Caesar's Palace and you don't go on, and the critics just slaughtered them, and it was a long time before they ever got invited back. And
that's for sure.
You know, you always think that the entertainment business has got... It's got so, you know, it always works so well, but just almost the opposite. When it works well, I'm almost surprised.
Yeah, and I'm not saying anything bad about anybody because the people I knew over the years and worked with were just really phenomenal, but there was something in every one of them that their life was so ego-driven that you just never knew what you're going to deal with these people, if somebody walking away or walking out at the last minute or... you know, doing a betrayal or some of these things that would happen over the years. And betrayal was another thing that I was uncovered in this book a lot, surprising betrayals. You and I in a private conversation, you had mentioned Mark Volman and the betrayal that happened in his life and in Mark Farner's life, or mammoth betrayals from dear, long, you know, old friends and things like that.
Ken, there's another quote from Ruth Pointer that I just found so poignant, and it said, sometimes God speaks in a soft, warm voice. Sometimes he uses the people around us who may have a clearer shot at getting through to us.
I know.
Sometimes he has to give a strong nudge along with an increase in his verbal admonitions to get our attention, but when he starts getting concerned that we may never respond to his softer touch, that's when he yells real loud.
Yeah. Yep. That's it.
Yeah, and sometimes it's simply you know, a slap up on the side of the head, and that's how he gets our attention.
That's right.
Yeah.
And some of us he has to hit with a baseball bat. Others he can maybe make a slight suggestion, but you know, some of us are just a little harder to get through at times.
Now the story of Brian Head Welsh I found fascinating because I have seen a number of his interviews, and he is a fascinating guy.
I would say out of the book, you know, the funny thing about it is there's 12 people in the hardcover book and 16 in the, including the ebook, and everyone seemed to have a really unusual power dynamic about him. But Brian Head Welsh is just like the meter is pegged, you know. His story and his personality and his fervor for the Lord are just like over the top. And Brian and I became really close during the book, and he got involved in helping my son through things. It's just his ministry is everything to him. And I was sitting and talking to him outside of Meeting 3, outside of Nashville once. And that's the kind of places we like to go, where there's not a lot of people around. And he started talking to me about his feelings about the Lord and his personal ministry and his heart and stuff like that. And I'm looking at his face, and here's this, you know, this long hair and this look he has. And it was so, he was so deep into his love for the Lord that I actually for a minute there thought Jesus was talking to me. Because it was just the kind of things that Jesus would say to you if he were sitting here today, you know. And but that was just how pure his heart was, how it came across. And his story is one you just can't imagine. You know, you read the story, how this guy did become so saved, I guess you could say. And, you know, such a powerful force for the Lord from where he was and the struggles he had.
Because these guys are just, everything is thrown at them.
Yeah, yeah, and he really wallowed in the mire. I mean, he really was down there, and he tried to get out, and it just kept pulling him back. And pulling back so many times, you thought, you know, there's no way this guy will ever get out of the mess he's in.
And even in the
beginning,
yeah, Ken, even in the beginning when Brian talks about his father's anger and the way that he had to deal with that, and he dreaded any sort of confrontation, whenever he was faced, and he said even when he was in school, he couldn't do confrontation, and so he got picked on and bullied all the time, and his nickname, Brian Head Welch, the head part, was because they thought his head looked too big for his body.
Yeah.
So he was getting picked on a long, long time ago.
Right, and the interesting thing in this, Bill, is during the course of he and I working together, and his father came to the Lord and was a very nice man, and to see the turnaround in their lives because of Brian's, you know, ministry is just beautiful. So here's Brian, you know, ministering to my son, and I'm Brian's having me sending things to his father, and it's just really a beautiful, beautiful thing to do something on such a ground level together.
Yeah, we're talking today to Ken Mansfield. He's written a book called Rock and a Heart Place, and if you have a question or have a story that sounds similar and you want to give us a call, feel free at 1-877-933-2484. I think we got a couple books we can still give away. Ken, when I was reading the book, of course, here in Minneapolis, we feel very close to Prince because he's a hometown boy, and the story of Dez was absolutely riveting.
Yes.
Did you get a chance to spend much time with him?
Well, yeah. In fact, Dez and I have one of the longer histories of the people in the book, and he and I didn't realize it when we first became friends because we went to the same church together, and we were, you know, I was out kind of, I'm known as the Beatles guy, and he's known as the Prince guy, so we knew things that most people don't know, the dynamics of what we'd been through and our lives coming to what they came to. So there's a very special relationship with Dez and I. And the thing that Dez really brought to the fore on this is through Dez, he totally takes racial things out of the equation. You know, he really goes to who we are before the Lord, you know, and color and everything. Nothing matters except our relationship with God. And Dez is one person that brings that point through clearer than anybody I've ever met. And he really ministered to me deeply in a lot of areas.
Well, it sounds like, you know, the experiences that you've had with some of these artists, and of course, I know you're not name-dropping because they're actual friendships and relationships, but you have to understand, it sounds kind of funny to the average listener. You know, as I was hanging out with, you know, McCartney.
I know.
You know, it's very fascinating. And we were talking to Ken Mansfield, and he's written a book called Rock and a Heart Place. We're going to take a break here in about 30 seconds, Ken. But if you have a question or comment for Ken and want to get on the air, you can do so at 1-877-933-2484. And we'll try to take your call. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Today is Neil is stuck against the Velcro wall, and I don't feel sorry for him. Not at all. I told him once. I told him 1,000 times. Stay away from the Velcro wall. Bill Arnold sitting in. We'll be right back. To Connecting Faith, it seems wrong to be interrupting that song, doesn't it, Ken?
I know, I
just
love
seems
that
wrong. We're talking to Ken Mansfield today. He's written a book called Rock and a Heart Place, chronicles the life of many rock and rollers that went from rebellion to sweet salvation. And right before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about Dez, who was a guitarist for Prince, and he was talking about he said, I opted out of the whole church thing as a teenager and began to pursue what was my true religion, the Church of Dez becoming rich and famous. And I would imagine that's pretty much what every rock and roller wants, period.
Yeah, and Dez especially. I have never met anybody more focused in my life. And you know, you read in the story about how that expressed itself sometimes with Dez's maybe anger and things like that. But when you take a person like that and then the Lord, you know, turns that around, that is something that's incredible, because I told you earlier on the air here that he really ministered to me and he would sit and look me straight in the eye, and he would cut me no slack. You know, and we all kind of have these little areas. Well, I can kind of alter this. I'm a believer, but I'll kind of make this one fit me a little bit better. And boy, you could never run that past Des and get away with it. You know?
One of the things, Ken, that he said in the book was the thing about fame is if you don't watch out, it'll make you break your own rules.
That's right.
He said, being a new Christian, without anyone around to follow me in this new life, I was like a plane flying on instruments in a dense fog. If your instruments were off, you were in danger.
That's right. That's right. Fascinating story. Fascinating story. And when you went to a Prince concert, it was hard to decide whether you wanted to watch Prince or Des on stage, because Des was just magnificent up there. And he was also, I think, the top 10 guitar solos of all time in rock and roll has been designated as the one that Des did on one of the Prince albums.
Yeah,
the
I know.
The guy was hot.
I know that. I know that for a fact, because I'm number 11 on that list.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
So.
That's the way. Yeah.
See, but no one ever talks about that. You know, they always talk about the top 10.
Yeah, and we're not going to talk about it today, Bill, so let's move on.
Oh, thank you so much. All right, Richie Furay. Sing his praises. Story. I love that guy.
That was his and Ruth's are the stories that Ruth's made me actually cry out loud. Richie just broke my heart with his story. There was so much pain, so much perseverance in his story, so much just stuff that just broke my heart, and you could so identify with what he went through and how he just hung in there and how his faith saw him through and how it's turned out. And this, we're not talking about he had a couple bad weekends. He had things that went on for years, and he just stayed faithful to the Word and to his what he felt the Father wanted him to do with his life.
Yeah. Can you talk a couple about some of that?
Well, a lot of that, Richie was like a lot of us who, that was a particular era with the folk groups, with Poco and Buffalo Springfield and the Burrs and all these people. We were like a different kind of group of people, and most of us grew up simple, with innocence, coming out of kind of really plain. We didn't have like a really exciting stories from where we came. We just came from kind of standard places. And when we hit with all this, I'm saying we because I was very involved in that area, the fame was something that none of us had a clue how to deal with it. We didn't have families that were famous. We didn't have people that could tell us what to look for and what to do and how to handle it. So Richie, like everybody else, in our innocence, we just, okay, now we, you know, we grew up poor, and now we we have all this and all these temptations, and they were just natural to kind of go with the flow. So this led Richie into some really sad situations, and the heart of it is in his marriage and the things that he went through, messing up the marriage and reconstructing the marriage and just his heart through this. And Richie really describes the road. Nobody knows the road unless somebody's been out there, and I'm talking years and years and years on the road, and all that it does to a person, and all how incredible it is, how horrible it is, how liberating it is, and how prison-like it can become. And Richie really lets you see inside that world what it's like. But then what he does more than that, he takes you out of that into the real life, and that transition back and forth was just fascinating. And he really nailed it for me, because I've written a lot about the road, and he's somebody that really understands what that's about.
I mean, the road, it can be so horribly dysfunctional for people. I mean, it absolutely can just destroy their lives, can't it?
It really can. It becomes a separate reality, and you start believing it is real, you know, and you're not home. And like I've always said, the further away you go on the tour bus, the further away you get from home. And home becomes less real, and the road out there, the fans and the idol worshippers and the sex, drugs, rock and roll and all that stuff starts becoming more real than home and family and, you know, stability and things like that. And it's almost unavoidable. It's really almost unavoidable.
Yeah, I mean, there's also almost a survival instinct that they have on the road, trying to function and work and enjoy their fame and success, yet it just takes them down a very dark road most of the time.
It really does.
And once you're down that road, it's a little bit harder to extract because there's so much negative influence around every environment you're in.
Well, you come off of a concert with thousands, I mean multi-thousands of people and adulation and all these parties and stuff, and the next day you're on a plane, you're home, and you get off, and here's the kids, and here's the house, and the back fence needs fixing or whatever it is, you know, and it's just like such a whiplash. And then you find yourself really getting separated from the people you care the most about, which usually ends up being, you know, the wives of the entertainers and things like that. And they just don't have enough time together to build a strong communication and have a strong pattern in their lives. I've been tempted to write a whole book just on the road, maybe even leaving names out, just have it be what that is, because it's a mammoth, mammoth thing.
Mm-hmm. Ken, my first two vinyl albums were Sweet Baby James and
uh-huh.
Grand Funk Railroad.
Uh-huh.
So those
okay.
were like, I can still see those sitting next to my Sears and Roebuck stereo with the detachable speakers.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of stereo that you can spill a malt on it and it still doesn't ruin the sound quality.
I'm laughing because I remember that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It has that little sparkle glitter on the speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the Grand Funk Railroad story in your book, talk a little bit about that, because that's an old band that I still love.
Well, Mark's story, Mark, I would have to give him the muscle story of the whole book, because, I mean, he lost his father when he was 9 years old. He almost had fatal car wreck accidents and airplanes accidents, but he also basically lost his mother, who just couldn't handle what it did to their lives. Their lives. And so at 9 years old, he kind of had to become the man of the family. And when they got the fame, it was almost overnight in a way. And then he had derailed relationships during that, and he lost his fortunes. Super, super incredible betrayal in there. And millions of dollars of lawsuits and being robbed by their managers, being misled, and it just goes on and on and on. And manned up. And in the end, he came out and he's in an incredible place. I mean, the guy is just amazing.
We're getting to talk about some of the happy endings and some of the victorious stories. Certainly in your repertoire are just the opposite. And you can think of people, not to mention them, but stories that didn't end quite so well.
Yeah, unfortunately, those stories aren't in the book.
No, I know that, but I mean...
I know, but there's more of those, I have to tell you. There are more of those.
Isn't that sad?
And those of us who, you know, have been around a while, we don't have many people left. They've really, you know, gone away, and it's just sad to see what happens to many people, especially when you saw them and knew them during such incredible times. And then to see how it all... There's something that happened with these people. The 60s was something the world had never experienced on almost every level. And we're talking about, you know, Kennedy and the assassinations and the Vietnam War. And all these things were new things for the American people to experience. And then when the rock and roll stars, the fame came on so big, it had never been on that level before. There had never been that much money. And drugs came into our lives then. And then the sexual revolution came. And now you've got these young people out there that all of a sudden they got money like they never dreamed of. They have adulation. Maybe they came off of a farm and they with all their insecurities or whatever. And you had all this stuff piling on top of these people. And we were being told lies that, yeah, we know marijuana is not addictive. Don't worry, man. It just helps you chill out. And cocaine is not addictive. And if you get high on a psychedelic, you know, you actually, what you do is you get closer to God, and it's all beautiful, you know, and you know, love is getting closer to God, so free love is wonderful. And we were just living in this wash of lies, and most of us, because it happened so big and so young, that we didn't really have the stuff we needed to hang on to get through this. In saying that, and if you have time, we can cover this, but there are a couple stories in here. Their stories are different because they started out as Christians, and they went through all these same things, but they hung on to their faith, and they made it through at to the other end without giving in, without, you know, but they explain their stories beautifully, how they lived through Rudy Sarzo with Ozzy Osbourne's band.
Share a little bit about that.
Well, Rudy, a lot of them had like great background. Rudy's family escaped from Cuba. He moved eventually to New York, and the way he was able to establish himself as not being so unusual was being a good musician. So with that, then time, you know, over time, he became in parts of some of the biggest bands there were. But he had a very powerful upbringing, you know, was started in the Catholic Church where everybody in the family, you know, they did all the things you're supposed to do as religion. But as he evolved and his Christianity evolved, and he had such a strong basis that when he got into the world of Ozzy and the devil tried to use him in that world, and Ozzy tried to use him in that world, and the fact that he clung to his faith very powerfully, and then it makes some very powerful decisions. It could mean the end of his career, but he stayed with it and ended up becoming a very powerful witness to a lot of people. But there's a story of just hard down determination, street level, on your knees, determination to hang on to your faith as a young man who could be easily swayed. But Rudy had that one something in him that was so special. So that story is really a redeeming story.
Yeah.
Nedra Ross is the other one. And she was in the Ronettes. Phil Spector was their producer. They were, you know, touring with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. They were the bad girls of rock and roll. They had this big high hairdos and short skirts and tight dresses and beautiful girls. And they were totally in the decadent world. And Nedra very tightly hung on to her upbringing with her mama and everything like that. And when she went home, she knew she was going to have to do the dishes and stuff. That her life out there was not the real life. Her real life was what her mama told her to do. You know?
Yeah, so mama was keeping balance in her life and in her head.
That's right.
That's amazing.
And she's an amazing lady.
Yeah, we're talking to Ken Mansfield, wrote a book called Heart in a Rock and a Hard Place. And we're going to take a little break when we come back. We're going to have one more segment with Ken. Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith. Bill Arnold in today for Neil. Be back in a minute.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun. I'm a Jesus, he's all right. With my Savior.
Ted, that's awesome. That's a remake of Grand Funk. I love it. Bill Arnold today sitting in for Neil. We're talking today to Ken Mansfield, written a book called Rock and a Hard Place. Really a fun book. And Ken, I'm curious, what do you say to like people that come to you and say, you know, my son Jimmy's 12, he's pretty good on that guitar and he wants to be a rock star?
You know, in my ministry, because I speak at churches and colleges all over the country, this happens to me all the time, but usually it's Jimmy coming up to me more than the father do.
Yeah.
And usually Jimmy is like maybe the leader of the worship team or something, a really great musician. And the typical thing is they ask that question and want to go into secular music. So there's a dilemma, and this is really tough. If God has directed their talent, given their talent, to be a light into darkness, then I am all for that. But that is a world of demons. As much as it was incredible it was to me, is you're living amongst demons in the entertainment world all the time. And the first thing I tell them is they need to be very, very sure that they're called to do this, that is where God wants them. Because the minute they step into that world, they're under attack. And they need to keep their close ties to their family and their church. The communication has to be there all the time. They have to be a very strong link between them and their mentor in the church, whether it's a youth pastor or whoever it is in the church. They need to be under a constant and powerful prayer covering. Because without those, they really don't stand a chance. It's like, you know, going into the battle with a slingshot against the Russian army. You know, it's not going to happen. And because the thing I would hate to do, and basically if I have to give my opinion, I say don't do it. I mean, in the bottom line, then I'm working with the percentage, best percentage of averages, because most people that do go in don't make it, and most people that do go in do get banged up pretty bad. But I would hate to be the person that would tell somebody that God had ordained to go in there and have a voice in the darkness, become successful to where they can speak and people will listen to them because of their talent, and then the fact that they're a Christian. I don't ever want to discourage that and keep that from happening.
Ken,
it's a dilemma.
Yeah.
For me.
Ken, one of the things in the book that I really loved was the whole idea that if you feel like your life is too big of a mess to fix, it's not.
No, it's not.
Would you speak to that a little bit? Because it's one story after another of what appears to be utter destruction, and then out of the complete destruction comes a redeemed life.
That's right. And that is the point of the book. And this is about famous people and about stardom and the entertainment world. But fame is in that world, but success is the other thing that's in that world. And success is in every endeavor. And success will eat you up. The fame is just a fluff on the top of it, but success will eat you up. And you can mess up in that world as many times as you want. You can get as far away from God. You can turn your back on him. You can be aggressively bad to God, if you want to say that. You can do it all. You can do it over and over and over again. But when you finally realize the truth and you finally understand and he finally brings somebody in your life or something finally clicks inside of you, you come back and instantly, when you accept Jesus as your Savior, you are brand new. Doesn't matter how bad you've been, doesn't matter how long you've been, no matter ugly or whatever it is, you're beautiful, you're new, you have a fresh start. And nothing else in your life offers that complete package just like that. Nothing.
Yeah, and let's go to the cross here for a minute. I mean, you talk about pain and you talk about disappointment or destruction. And you look at what Jesus did on the cross, and he suffered all of it on our behalf. And it's because of that and his vulnerability and his willingness to die for our sins that we can have this redeemed life that we're talking about today.
That's right. And you can't help but look at the cross and look at the guy next to him who had spent a whole life. And this answers your question right here, Bill. He spent his whole life as a sinner. And in a matter of instance, he was saved for all time. It was never too late for him. Never too late.
And that's one of the most encouraging things that you can get from reading Rock in a Hard Place is these are fascinating stories. I mean, I think most of us love celebrities and we admire them and we wonder what their private lives might be like. But now, I mean, they're living out loud more than ever right now with all the social media. We know more about them than we probably care to. But back in this era and this time, it was a little bit harder to figure out what was going on with these guys and to think that they were handed all this success and all this fame, men and women, and the destruction that came along and then the redemption. It's a joyful book to read. I just really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What are some of the things that you just kind of hope the readers would, you know, take away from reading the book? Because I know what I walked away with, and it's really what I just shared, just that there's no life that can't be redeemed and no pain that can't be healed.
Well, that's pretty much the basic overall message. And what the book does, it gives you so many examples. It's like, well, if I did this, okay, you said that, that's wonderful. Well, what if I was this or what if this? You know, it's really in there. It's like even in the Bible where no matter what you come up against, the answer's in there, you know. And this is really answers the question of about redemption and the many avenues you can take to redemption, and especially highlighting the places you were, the wallow and the mire you were in before you got there. And I think you can't help but have hope if you read this book and you see these people, because the thing about their notoriety made the intensity of their problem so much harder to break loose from, and so many things to overcome. And if they can do it, you can see you can do it.
Yeah. Ken, after living the rock and roll life for so many years, what do you most appreciate right now about your new way of living, of course, which could include a second nap?
Yeah. I am so happy to not have to watch my back. I've surrounded myself, you know, except when I'm not ministering to people, the people around me are believers. We trust each other. We care about each other. We take care of each other. You don't have to worry about anybody stabbing you in the back. You are in an arena of always being available to help or to be helped. It's just a whole different lifestyle. There's a happiness. There's a joy. You know, guilt is a horrible thing. And when you're on the road, back to the road again, and you're out there committing adultery and getting stoned and doing all these things, and you come home to your life, you carry a lot of junk with you. And that stuff is very destructive. But to be saved, have the slate wiped clean, and then be able to have a life where you don't have this thing hanging like this shadow over you because you're such a, you know, such a sinner. I mean, we're all still sinners, but you know what I'm saying. You just don't have this guilt of your lifestyle hanging over you. It's just much better.
Yeah. We're talking to Ken Mansfield. Ken was at one point the U.S. manager of the Beatles at Apple Records, and we've only got a couple minutes left, Ken. So, fork over some Beatles stories.
Okay. Well, probably the thing that people want to know the most about is the roof. And I was on the roof the last time the band played together.
That's incredible.
Which was incredible. I was there. I just happened to be working out of the London offices that particular week, and we needed to get footage for the film Let It Be, and we couldn't go someplace and have a sane little show because they hadn't played together for years and years, and everybody would find out. It just became a mess. So finally, we locked the door downstairs to the Apple building. When the building was five stories tall, and we went up on top and did a concert up there where nobody could bother us. There's just like a dozen of us, you know, with the Beatles, and it was a special time. It was a special time for them. It's the last time they played together. The whole day turned out to be one of the most historic moments in rock and roll. And things were pretty awful then with them, with their relationships, with their lives, and in a way. And during that day, all the innocence came back. All the reasons they had become the Beatles were there. You could see them looking at each other in the film. And it was just special to be able to touch back on that with the Beatles amongst all the things that were going down. It was just really, really a neat day.
Was it one of those things that you were aware of in the moment, or
no?
Is it only one of those things that you can realize that you were one of the guys in the picture on the roof when the Beatles were doing their last concert?
Didn't have a clue. None of us thought, oh, wow, this is historical. Oh, gosh, the Beatles are going to break up after this. Oh, gee, we're seeing their last concert. Oh, you know. But the thing that did happen is when it was over and we all kind of filed off the roof down to our offices and stuff, is nobody talked. And all of us knew something had happened, but it was kind of so buried or something we didn't recognize, we just couldn't talk about it. And many of us did not talk about that for many, many, many years. It was just like, I guess it's something we treasured, something we knew was special. And then in time it unfolded how special that and how monumental that whole day was.
It's like not talking when you look at the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is now, all these years later, those of us who are up there were like, we were in a foxhole together. You know, we are just bound together for life. Everyone are just forever friends.
Well, Ken, you've been absolutely a fascinating guest. And the book is Rock and a Hard Place, Ken Mansfield with Marshall Terrell. He's written a book about chronicling the lives of many rock and rollers that went through destruction and rebellion to sweet salvation. And the book is a very easy read. Once you pick it up, you don't put it down. That was my experience anyway. And Ken, I know this is one book of many that you've written, but this one is your latest, and I recommend going to the website. You can check out the podcast on myfaithradio.com. Go to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for being with us today. Bill Arnold sitting in for Neil. Have a great day. Bye-bye.